Welcome to The Source on Utah Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Justin DeRose is a tree guy, through and through. When I met him at the Tree Ring Lab at Utah State University, he was wearing a t-shirt with a line drawing of an old, rough-looking western tree on it, a juniper or a pinyon. DeRose is a tree ring specialist with the Forest Service's Rocky Mountain Research Station, and he's heading up the collection of thousands of tree ring core samples from around northern Utah. I volunteered to tag along with him last field season to some tree ring sampling sites. He warned me that the hiking would be arduous, that there might be a large river crossing, and that the work would likely involve a handsaw or a chainsaw. He told me to bring 4 liters of water. I had been to an academic conference on dendroclimatology, so I thought I knew what I was getting into. I reported for duty at 7 a.m. First, we have to find some trees. We drive for almost 2 hours, half of it on a dirt road, and see nothing but sagebrush. Justin DeRose chose this spot from aerial photos and doesn't actually know if the trees here are any good. By any good, he means a couple hundred years old and what he calls sensitive to changes in moisture. This sensitivity is expressed in good, clear rings. Whiter means wetter, and thinner means drier. We crossed the state line just north of Snowville, Utah, and now we're in Oneida County, Idaho. The road forks up a draw, and we drive into what turns into a small canyon. The east slope is a giant landslide of loose rocks, and there are some junipers way up high.
Look at that. There's totally some bigger stems.
We grab our equipment and head straight up the scree field. DeRose leads by leaps and bounds. He's carrying a heavy chainsaw up the slope. When we get to the top, it's spitting frozen precipitation and the wind is howling. It's hard to believe trees can live up here, rooted in this loose rock, for very long at all. DeRose has sampled trees all over the West. In general, Douglas fir, limber pine, and pinyon yield the best climate clues, but in this region, junipers are pretty much the only trees around.
It appears to be the best species in this region to help us characterize the historical variability in moisture in the hydroclimate.
Turns out we don't need the chainsaw. We have a much more refined tool, an increment borer. You don't need to kill trees to get tree ring samples. These aren't the big slabs of wood you see in museums. The increment borer is a long, thin metal straw. The samples that come out of the tree are thinner than a chopstick. The tree doesn't even know that part of it is missing.
How deep of a core do you need?
Well, we like to get as many rings as we can. I'm gonna go ahead and pull it. So just give it a turn or two, and then you're ready to extract it. So, bunch of bark, some rings. Looks like somewhere into the 1800s, 100, 150 years old.
The oldest sample we collect today is around 700 years old by DeRose's best guess. The dozens of cores collected from these junipers will go back to the lab at Utah State University to be prepped and dated by a machine that reads them by scanning them in like a barcode. They'll become part of a western-wide tree census, and all of their climate data will become brushstrokes in the big picture of wet and dry in the West. But more than just a historical document, this picture is a window into the future. A window that water managers and city planners and legislators will be clamoring over each other to look through. Justin DeRose and his research group are reconstructing Utah's climate watershed by watershed. The junipers I sampled with Justin belong to the Bear River watershed. The Bear River, which starts in the Uinta Mountains in Utah and flows through Wyoming and Idaho before heading back into Utah, is the largest source of fresh water to the Great Salt Lake. It's a massively important river to northern Utah, including the urban areas of the Wasatch Front. What we know about the Bear River comes from instruments that have been recording river flows since 1943. That's it, 1943. You probably already know enough about the climate record in the West to know that 70 years worth of data is not that much data in the grand scheme of things. Also, the last 40 years or so have been the second wettest period in this area in the last 8 centuries. Second wettest. We've made decisions about how to allocate the water of the Bear River across 3 states using an instrument record that's only a generation old. That's what's so cool about trees. They've been recording data since long before we invented machines to do it for us. Justin DeRose has a paper coming out in the Journal of Hydrology. It includes a reconstruction of the Bear River stream flow that goes back 1,000 years. I caught up with him at the Tree Ring Lab at Utah State University. Last time we met, we were in, I think, Oneida County, Idaho, just across the border from Utah, sampling some...
Utah juniper, Juniperus osteosperma. That's right, we're somewhere in southern Idaho. And we have specifically chosen a number of sites in about a 100-mile radius around the Wasatch Front, where we are purposely sampling Utah juniper at low elevations. The reason we do that is because trees at low elevation tend to see drought earlier than trees at high elevation. Just like this year, where there's no snow down in the foothills and there's plenty of snow up on top. So trees down in the foothills are going to have, it's going to be reflected in their growth, that lack of moisture. And so once we selected those sites, as you saw, we went out and we cored trees with increment borers. And we did that for live trees specifically because we knew what season we were there, and then we can take pattern of ring width increment. Trees in this region add one growth ring per year, except in particularly bad years. And so with those live trees, we know what year, what season that last growth ring was laid down. And so we are pinned down in time. And we do that for dozens of trees at a site, so we replicate the record. There's no question that the year-to-year variability is similar between those trees at that where we sampled. But each individual record records something about the local climate that may be useful to us. Once we have those records, we can lengthen them back in time by collecting deadwood. So standing dead trees are trees that are dead on the ground. And that allows us to extend the chronology back in time as long as the oldest deadwood, which we've, in this region, we've found deadwood on the ground that's up to 1,500 years old.
The Bear River reconstruction is important because it's the first to use exclusively Utah juniper, a species that tree ring researchers didn't think was very good for extracting climate data. So why did DeRose decide to use it for the Bear River reconstruction? Well, it was the only tree available.
To our knowledge, this will be the first dendroclimatological reconstruction that's used Utah juniper. And in our region, that's really important. We have a lot of Utah juniper. We don't have pinyon. We don't have old Douglas fir to work with, so we really are relying on Utah juniper.
Utah juniper lives in pretty inclement places, places that other trees can't or don't live. And why wouldn't we want to hear what this tough little tree has to say about surviving a 70-year drought, for instance?
What we don't see in the instrumental record that we do see in the past are these decade-long, extremely dry periods where we have many years, up to 14, 15, 16 years in a row, with well below average stream flow. We found that in the Weber record for the for a drought in the early 1600s, and we corroborated that drought with the Bear record, but found a much longer and drier period in the 1200s. The Bear reconstruction shows that there may have been a drought that was up to 7 decades long.
Can we look at some samples?
Sure.
The samples from my trip to the juniper site in Idaho are with DeRose's colleague at Brigham Young University. But we sort through some boxes of samples, and we find some from other sites collected during the same field season. The fragile cores are glued to a piece of wood the size of a schoolroom ruler, with some basic information scribbled on it, like the date and the place it came from, and these random dots.
There's a convention to applying those dots so that any dendrochronologist can pick up this increment core and quickly figure out where we were in time, and then measure it if it needed to be measured.
So what can you tell just by looking at this sample?
So I can quickly
look for the triple dots that indicate the century. So there's 1900, 1800, 1700, 1600. So this tree is probably about, the inside ring on this tree is started somewhere around 1600.
DeRose shows me a bunch of slabs too. If there's dead wood or if he gets a permit from the Forest Service to cut down a living tree, he gets these beautiful museum quality crosscuts, which are much easier to process than the increment cores. I'm starting to see tree rings when I close my eyes, and Justin's got thousands of years from thousands of trees to inventory, so I leave him to it.
I don't know what this is.
People just
looks
bring
like
you.
It's from someone's yard.
Oh, people just bring you pieces of wood.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for all the information.
You're welcome.
It's time for a quick break. When we come back, I talk to two of Justin's colleagues in the Wasatch Dendroclimatology Research Group about what happens to the data Justin and his students painstakingly record from each of these tree ring core samples. Find out what climate researchers see when they look into Utah's woody past when we return.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water with water expertise at its source. And by iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
The job? Waitress. The country? Germany.
It would be wonderful to live with my money. What I earn in my job, but it's not enough without help of the state.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Next time on Marketplace, trying to make it in a global economy. It's from 8 p.m.
Friday night at 7 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio belongs to you, and we want to know what you think. Please take a few minutes and fill out UPR's new station survey. You'll find it online at upr.org. Tell us which programs you love or those you can't stand. We'd love to know the issues and topics you want to hear more of on UPR. You can also comment about what you value about the service UPR provides and what needs improvement. Determine the future of what you hear. Your programs, your voice, your UPR. Please take the survey now at upr.org. Thanks.
You're listening to The Source on Utah Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Pemberton, and I'm joined in the studio by Roger Kellgren and Simon Wong, who, among many other roles at Utah State University and in the state of Utah, belong to a research group called the Wasatch Dendroclimatology Research Group, which is WADR for short, W-A-D-R, which on the radio sounds exactly like water, W-A-T-E-R.
Well, we do want to emphasize a D in there, so WADR.
So. WADR. So if you hear us saying the water research group, it's not the generic water research group. So maybe we could just start with each of you introducing yourself and talking about what you do specifically for the research group, what your role is, how you got involved. Something like that, and we will start with Dr. Kellgren.
I'm Roger Kellgren. I'm a professor in plant soils and climate. My expertise is tree physiology, and it's throughout my career I focused on water relations, so how trees use water and what happens when they run out of water. And 4 years ago, the next logical step was, geez, I look at that in urban landscapes, but if we look at it in a natural setting and the trees don't grow very much, it tells us what happened with the water. And so it was kind of a meeting of the minds. The stars were in alignment. And a group of us, another group on campus, Tammy Rittenauer in geology, had just gotten a small grant to study tree rings. So we all got together and said, we have a lot of interest. And there's a huge gap in terms of tree ring reconstructions and tree ring chronologies, which is what we use. It's the pencil-thin core that we pull out of a tree, measure the rings. We do 20 or 30 of them, and we have a chronology. There was none in northern Utah. And here we have a need to understand this climate, and we don't have any way to do it. So we all saw the need to collect tree cores and develop reconstructions. And so our colleague, Justin DeRose in the Forest Service, who is a tree ring person through and through, I'm just a dilettante, and Matt Becker, also a tree ring person, have gone out and collected the cores, processed it. And then Simon takes the cores and the reconstructions of climate and then sleuths out and mines interesting insights from that data.
Dr. Wong, do you want to talk about a little bit more about your role and what happens when you get that information from the field?
Hi, my name is Simon Wong. I'm technically a meteorologist by training. So my work in research-wise usually touches water before they hit the ground. So something that generates rainfall, snowfall, and that trace into storm and what forms the storm, and then, you know, and you can go from there, atmospheric process, ocean process. That's usually the things that I do. Doing those research is fun, but as you know, the first operational satellite wasn't there until, you know, late 70s. That means we have really little data compared to long records like tree ring can offer. And to understand climate variability, climate change, we need a lot of data, which we don't have. So the tree ring research that Roger has just mentioned really filled in this gap. It allows us to understand or verify, you know, what we have been seeing for the past 30, maybe 40 years of variability holds true in the past for the past, you know, couple hundred years or even longer. We have used a existing chronology, meaning the tree ring data from the Uinta basins. It was done by another group outside Utah. But we found that it was really excited and encouraging to find that the patterns, the cycles that we have noticed for the past 60 years actually is very well recorded through our 763 years of records.
It's interesting that we have, in recent years, such sophisticated equipment to monitor and see data in climate and all of this information, all of these instruments, and they don't go back very far. And in the meantime, we've had trees that have been recording data in the same way that a stream gauge or a precipitation gauge or a snow tell would have done if it had been invented when the trees were actually recording this information. Maybe, Roger, you could talk a little bit about the history of when people started looking to trees to answer some of these questions, or maybe when we realized that trees had the answers to some of these questions.
It actually started at the turn of the century in Arizona, in studying or archaeological studies of Pueblo, Navajo, some of the Native American settlements in that part of the country, where a perceptive researcher noticed that tree rings varied from year to year. And he started to peek at the weather records of rainfall and noted that there was a relationship between the width of the rings and the annual rainfall. And that actually meshed quite well with what we understand, even at that time, that if plants don't get water, they don't grow very well. If you don't water your turf grass, it'll eventually die. But these trees are adapted to drought, so they don't die. But if they don't get water, they simply don't grow. And so this individual then was basically the catalyst for it. And to this day, the University of Arizona in Tucson then is kind of the citadel of tree ring research. And then since then, it's spread to other parts of the country. There's a strong program in Arkansas, one at Columbia University, and then around the world, because it's the only way to pull back the curtain of time and understand what climate has been doing past our historical record. What has expanded the field is that they use the tree rings as a proxy for other water-related features and phenomenon. So they found early on that if you took the tree ring width and looked at the stream flow, the flow of a river, they matched up. Well, the trees aren't really pulling water out of the river, But the same weather factors that if you have a low snowfall year and the tree runs out of water fast, doesn't grow very much, means there's less runoff. And so there's less water in the rivers. So the tree rings are a proxy for factors like stream flow and maybe, for example, snowpack, that they don't directly measure it, but they're being affected by the same factors, so they can represent these other weather-based, climate-based features that we're interested in.
So the research project that the water group, the mm-hmm. water research group, mm-hmm. water as in dendroclimatology, water with a D.
Bingo.
What that group has been doing is reconstructing stream flows historically. Mm-hmm. So taking rivers and showing sort of volume of how much water was in the river and therefore how much water had fallen as precipitation in the previous months or years. Or mm-hmm. if we have a stream flow reconstruction mm-hmm. for a specific watershed or a river, maybe this is a question for Simon, how do we recreate climate from looking at a stream flow? It's just one set of data, mm-hmm. But it seems like it's the culmination of a lot of information. So how do you decode that stream flow reconstruction and sort of see the bigger picture of what climate was like?
Well, stream flow basically is an accumulation of rainfall eventually, and it's accumulation of a lot of rainfall over a, you know, extensive land, a watershed. So it's actually a very good variable, because if you notice rainfall, you will know that the rain gauge from your backyard and comparing that to the rain gauge from your neighbor's yard will be different, because the rainfall pattern is quite sparse. I mean, it's quite chaotic. So we have found through all the little papers published by the water group, three different watersheds from northern Utah to south northern Utah. And you will see that although all the three different rivers shows a slightly different patterns, they also have the consistent variations. Those are the climate signals that we know is not just local, but on a regional base. Regional means can be a statewide or can be the whole region-wide for the Western U.S. And me as a meteorologist and also the Climate Center staff researchers, we are meteorologists in training to look after the forcing, the mechanisms of this kind of signals.
There's been a few of these reconstructions have been published so far, the Weber River and the Logan River and the Great Salt Lake mm-hmm. water level. The Bear River is...
Just came out.
Before these streamflow reconstructions came out, what kind of data sets did... What were you looking at? Because when you see them as a chart, peak flow, up, down, mm-hmm. up, down, it seems really compelling to sort of see highs and lows and all of those patterns. What kind of data did you have before the tree ring reconstructions or these water reconstructions to look at to see historical patterns?
You have gauge, so that's instrument data. And we all know instrument comes with civilization, so they can only go back for as long as the people place them. So those are the only data we could use. So those are usually very short.
So now that we can see deeper into the past, it seems like the short-term patterns, we sort of thought we knew what they looked like. And then all of a sudden, when you see back 1,000 years, those patterns don't look quite the same. I know with the Bear River reconstruction that a lot of that became very pronounced, that we realized the last 50 years have been pretty wet.
Some of the second wettest, I think, in the past 1,200 years.
And maybe from standing where we stand right now, it doesn't really seem that wet. It's all about context, right?
Things are changing. I think one of the key points that was made in the Bear River reconstruction paper is that things seem to shift in a millennial sense around the year 2000. Now, that wasn't a Y2K issue. It was simply that it seems like we've been getting drier, and actually throughout the West for the past 15 years. The Colorado River has been hit hard by the same trend, that overall flows are lower than they were up to the year 2000. Occasional years like 2011 are wet, but overall, it's lower. You just have to see the bathtub ring at Lake Mead to know that, no, they haven't been getting quite what they used to.
Or the Great Salt Lake.
Right. Yeah, that's a bit scary. It's more than a bit scary with the Great Salt Lake.
What are the plans for the water research group? What other data are it sort of planned to go after?
Our next goal is to reconstruct the Provo River. And the Provo River is, I wouldn't say it's a mess. It's just complicated because the population center of the Wasatch Front is in the southern end, Utah County and Salt Lake County. But that's where the least water is. And so the Provo River is actually an extremely important artery, if you will, supplying water to the entire Wasatch, or the Salt Lake County, Utah County, because it itself, it doesn't have much water. But a big chunk of water is moved over from the Uinta Basin into the Provo, and that water ends up on the lawns in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County. And also, the Provo has a, there's a big straw that goes from the Weber River into the Provo. So 80 years ago, somebody thought that was a good idea. The people in the South End don't think that way now, but they still pull a big chunk of water out of the Weber River way up high, and that goes into the Provo. So there's three different sources of water going into the Provo, and then that water ends up in Utah County and Salt Lake County.
And that's the last big river in northern Utah?
Well, actually, no, because Salt Lake City itself gets, I don't know, I think about 40% of its water from the streams like City Creek east of Salt Lake in the mountains. And so I think that would be the last one, is to see how the tree rings relate to these smaller creeks that supply a good chunk of water to Salt Lake City.
It seems very obvious, the implications of this research for water resource managers in the state, in the West. Who else is this research for? What are the other applications of this research?
Everybody has a stake in this. And so what part of our job is to translate this to a level that everyone can understand, because everyone has a stake in it. And everyone, through awareness, can make choices that would benefit the society at large. So it really is everybody. I know that sounds kind of like a let's hold hands and sing kumbaya, but it really is. It really is for everybody.
Simon, what do you want to do with this research?
We have seen promise. We have done analysis, but we are trying to break the mold of the convention of thinking of this dendrochronology. We may not need to really go and be selective. We can just randomly sample trees. This is directed against the conventional thinking of finding the right place, finding the right species, and pick up the most climate-sensitive trees. I wouldn't say this revolutionary, because this is all our dendrochronology approach, but the thinking is different, the approach is different. The things we can look at will be different. Because by doing this, the FIA program has collected thousands, actually tens of thousands, of tree cores awaiting analysis. And it's labor intensive, but the trade-off is you no longer are restricted to one watershed or one stream. You have data points covering the entire Western United States. So we can create a very good map and data resource for our climate, stream, soil moisture, snowpack, etc., back to the past.
So the FIA, the Forest Inventory, is like a census of
yes.
trees in the West, right? Mm-hmm. And all of that information is like all the demographic information.
Exactly.
So in the same way that the census would say how old people are and what jobs they have
yes.
and where they live and how many acres they
yes.
have, and this says mm-hmm. tells us that about trees.
So that would be what I call a water big data project.
That's very big data.
this forest inventory assessment was actually mandated by Congress. So the United States can get an understanding of its forest resources. So it really is a very, very big project across, I think, every state that has a tree, I think. And so it's a very, very large data set, and we're simply mining that in a way that no one has thought about before.
And we're trying to really try to convince the mainstream tree ring scientists that this can work. We haven't been so successful yet in convincing. We have been successful in showing that they do pick up very good hydroclimate, climate signals like precipitation and snowpack.
Well, in using, I think, a species like Utah juniper, which was very unconventional for tree ring research because a lot of researchers thought that it didn't pick up those signals and that, but is it true that Utah juniper was pretty much used almost exclusively in the Bear River recreation?
There was just one site that was used. It was one up by probably about 30 miles northeast of Park City by Colville. And it happens to be a site where the trees were sitting in a bowl, a south-facing bowl, that had basically acted like a solar reflector, putting a whole lot of heat on these trees. And so it's a very stressful site.
I heard that that hike was extremely difficult.
You look at the size of the boulders, and I wasn't on it, but it, just looking at the pictures made my blood turn cold. But it's an extremely sensitive site because it is one of those that has that particular orientation south, so it's hot. It has a bowl, and so that also traps heat, and it's a fairly steep slope. So it had all the conditions of an extremely stressful site. And then Utah juniper is truly one of the toughest trees out there. Along with cockroaches, it will probably survive a nuclear holocaust.
And yet it's not our state tree.
Well, you know, don't know quite how to answer that one.
It's just a fact. It's not our state tree.
And it's the only tree species that has Utah in its name,
I know,
too.
But school children haven't written a song about it yet.
No,
so
they have not. No, I'm sorry. But they have moved away from Colorado blue spruce, I believe.
Yes, we're on to the aspen now.
Aspen, okay, which is found everywhere in North America.
Which is fine. But I do, the Utah juniper is a really special tree. I mean, not just sort of emotionally, but it's
a tough customer is what it is. Mm-hmm. It actually has a I wouldn't say a unique, but an uncommon water use strategy. It's a go for broke, use it or lose it. And what it does, and you can see that just out in nature, it is rarely in competition with other plants. And there's no such thing as Utah juniper forest in the sense that the crowns don't touch. And that's because each tree beats out the competition. It uses every drop of water it has at the surface, so nothing else can compete. And then it simply hunkers down for the heat of the summer. Okay, aggressive, kind of like the Wall Street of brokers, right?
I was going to say kind of like Utahns in general.
Okay, well, you know, you're the one saying that, not me. So
it's a very pioneering tree.
It's a pioneering. It's a tough cookie. It can tolerate most anything, and it's let's just say it's an entrepreneurial tree species.
Anything else you guys want to add to this conversation? It's been really good stuff. I hope we've gotten a lot of the big picture of the water research group and applications. Is there anything we're missing?
If I may add, being climate scientist, the ultimate goal is to look into the future. All the things we did, no matter how deep or how broad we dig into the past, is just to add that one more knowledge base so that we can look at to the next few months, next few years, next decade with better accuracy. And all this turns into prediction science because there has been a saying, the best mitigation strategy or a tool has been good prediction. So you know what is coming. I just want to add that all the efforts that's been put into creating this analysis, prolonging the records, finding more or new signals is to help us look at to the next big events better that way.
Good point. We don't ever study history just for the sake of studying history, right?
Of course.
It's a fascinating program. It's a great project. I thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
That was Roger Kellgren and Simon Wong, researchers at Utah State University who work with tree ring data to help plan for Utah's water future. When The Source returns, we hear from a familiar voice here on Utah Public Radio, meteorologist Danny Berendieren. He's working on reconstructing the history of snowpack in northern Utah's mountains. So in addition to telling us if there's powder in our near future, he might be able to tell us if we've always had the greatest snow on Earth, and if we can expect to keep that slogan in the coming decades. I know if you have any interest in the state's climate future, that is probably what you want to know. So stay tuned.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water with water expertise at its source. and by iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
Who says staying fit can't be fun? Join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health for great tips on healthy living, like this recipe for
cranberry pecan sweet potatoes.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm here in the studio with meteorologist sometimes, Danny Berendieran, who our audience will know as a weekly forecaster here on Utah Public Radio. And Danny is also so much more than just a weather guy. Danny, first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is The Source on Utah Public Radio. I'm hoping you can just start by telling us a little bit of the difference between what you do for us on a weekly basis as a meteorologist and what you do as a climate researcher.
Sure. My bachelor's degree is in meteorology, but all my graduate work has been in climatology, and that's really what I do. I'm not a very good weather forecaster, and I always tell all my friends that, which is one of the reasons why I switched to climatology. So basically the difference between climatology and meteorology is looking at your day-to-day weather. You know, what's going to happen in the next week? Is it going to rain on Tuesday? How hot is it going to get? You know, that sort of thing. And it's very short term, whereas climatology, you're looking at longer term picture, more averages. What do you expect around this time of year? How exceptional is this lack of precipitation we've gotten this year? Or, you know, things along that line. So it's more of a question of how big of a time period you're looking at, how big of a time slice.
Meteorology is about planning what to wear, and climatology is about planning where to put your cities and when to plant your crops.
Yeah, exactly.
So what time period do you look at? What's your specific research sort of addressing and focusing on?
Right. So here at Utah State, I've been looking at, in both directions actually, backwards to so far about 1850, and we're hoping to go a little further into the past, and we'll get to that in just a moment. And future-wise, we're looking ahead to what's going to happen over the course of the 21st century. One of the things that that I look for in my research is I'm particularly interested in drought. Drought occurs in the western United States over, you know, sometimes it can be just a couple years. There's evidence of multi-decade droughts in the past. So by looking to the past, we can get a better idea of what the range of possibilities are for, you know, whatever climate variable that you're interested in. In my case, water.
Is there a relationship between temperature and water?
Yes, there is. There's a couple of ways in which they're related. First off, you know, in a sort of global sense, when you heat up the atmosphere, it also can carry more water than if it's colder. And so if you, on average, heat up the globe, you can also expect, on average, to have more precipitation than in the cooler period. All things being the same, if you get the same amount of precipitation year after year, but you're heating up constantly, you're going to end up with less available water just because evaporation has increased.
So let's go back to looking at the past real quick. So a
sure.
Sort of methodology question. How do we know how much water there was in 1850 in Utah, for example?
Sure. Okay. So the instrumental record, you know, is sort of our baseline for knowing what's happened, right? Now, of course, there wasn't someone out in the mountains measuring snowpack in 1850. So we have to go about it through different means. And one of the things that our research group has been working a lot with is using tree rings to approximate the amount of snowpack that you had. There's a lot of things that you can estimate using tree rings. You can estimate precipitation, snowpack, stream flow, even temperature. We're working on measuring the dryness of the soil. So there's a variety of things that you can do with tree rings.
We should talk about specifically what the instrumentation for measuring
snowpack looks like. So, you know, you said in 1850 there weren't people walking around with, you know, sticks in the snow. But how do you measure how deep the snow is? Is it a big stick?
It is a very big stick. And there's a variety of measurements that need to be made to get an accurate picture of just how much water that snowpack represents, because I'm sure anyone who's shoveled a sidewalk or a driveway will know some snow is a lot heavier than others, and that difference in weight is, you know, represents a difference in water content. So what they do, yes, they measure depth. You know, they just stick a really deep stick in the ground and, you know, it tells you just how deep it is. So the other thing they do is they stick a similarly length piece of pipe into the snow and pull it out. And then you've got a core of snow, which you weigh, and that tells you how much water is in that column of snow. So that's the old style. That's a way of measuring water content of snowpack. Now they have these automated stations, and they have a little pillow, and they fill it up with air. And as the snow, you know, piles up on top of it, that air gets compressed by the weight of the snow column above it. And so based on the pressure of the air inside the pillow, they know how much snow is on top of it.
And that's the snowtell?
That's snowtell. Yes, that's right.
And people can actually see the snowpack at sort of any given moment, right?
Yeah, that's right. They report in real time, and they have a very extensive network. Now, unfortunately, snowtell sites have only been used since about 1979, and they really didn't fill in the network until about the mid-80s. And so there's a limited length of time from that particular record. And one of the things that's really important for tree ring reconstructions is that you need the longer your overlap between the observations and the tree rings, the better off you're going to be. You get better statistics and you get better models. So snowtell, unfortunately, is not really long enough of a record to use for this particular construction. So I rely on the pipe measurements.
So all of this snowpack measuring and reconstruction and using the tree rings and looking back into the past, for your research at least, is to determine when droughts start, how long they last. You know, you're trying to define drought periods. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. We're basically trying to get a better idea of what is the range of possibilities. And that also relies on statistics. And also, you get a better estimate the longer your record is. And so there's a lot of interest in extending, you know, the estimates of snowpack or precip or stream flow, whatever, as far back as possible, so you can get a better idea of how often can I expect this severity of drought? How long of a drought can we expect based on what's happened in the past?
So are we in a drought?
Yes, we're in a drought. Our current research and understanding of, you know, the cycles of precip in the Great Basin indicate that we should be, you know, making a pivot sometime in the next couple years. So hopefully it won't be too many more of these winters before we start to see wetter ones. You know, the Western U.S. in general has been really dry. And I moved to Colorado in 2003. And I remember back then there were some good years, but, you know, things were drying out quite a bit. And it's really been rough for, you know, the most of the Western states for some time now. I mean, California is really suffering right now, you know, and they're kind of newcomers to the game, so to speak. But it's a very widespread drought. You know, it doesn't just cover one little region.
To wrap up, I like to know what gets researchers excited. I mean, for me, it's really cool to look at these reconstructions and to understand that we have a pretty good, not even just a guess, I mean, we have a very good statistical idea of what the climate looked like.
Yeah.
And therefore could look like in the future.
Mm-hmm.
What are the big questions you're asking of your research, or what are you even just curious about that maybe you can't even address yet?
There are a couple of big questions, particularly for the Great Basin, that remain to be answered. So people are pretty familiar at this point with the phenomenon known as El Nino, right? That wasn't necessarily the case about 30 years ago, but in the early 80s, there was a pretty heavy El Nino and another one in the mid 90s. Now, some people, you know, have kind of fallen into this trap of, you know, whatever it might be, oh, it's El Nino. And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, here in Utah in particular, it doesn't really have as much of an impact on our climate as other regions might. El Nino acts kind of like a seesaw. There's El Nino and La Nina, right? During El Nino, the Pacific storm track gets shifted southward, and so California gets a lot of what Washington and Oregon would get, and then La Nina is the other way around. And so you've got this sort of wet, cold seesaw over the western U.S., and Utah sits right at the rocking point. So whichever way it goes, it doesn't have as much of an effect. Now, there are other factors in the Earth's climate that do have more of an effect. There's a greater need for a deeper understanding of other influences that come from maybe just the atmosphere, or maybe from the sun, or maybe from, you know, the changing polar ice cap. You know, there's a variety of potential forcing on local climate that come from global sources. And so that's one of the things that gets us really excited, is looking at the broader picture and trying to get a better understanding of all the myriad details that influence our climate. On a personal note, you know, and one of the reasons why I'm so excited about climatology, or just, you know, and it was meteorology before that, and I remember growing up as a kid, you know, and we lived on the Texas coast, and the hurricanes would miss us every year. It was so disappointing. But just watching, you know, the storms develop out on the ocean, it's really fascinating. And the energy that's involved is just, it blows the mind to think, you know, how much energy a hurricane releases, say, or, you know, one of these big snowstorms. They pack a punch, you know, and it's something that, you know, you can only stand back in awe at the power of nature. And getting to understand how these things happen, you know, back in the day, it was the gods, right? They're angry at us, and so they're going to kill us with heat or with, you know, 10 feet of snow. But actually understanding what is behind these things is what gets me out of bed every day.
Danny Barandieran, a researcher with the Utah Climate Center, sometimes meteorologist here on Utah Public Radio. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Next month on The Source, we'll be talking about the Great Salt Lake, specifically about what it means and what happens when the water gets historically low like it is right now. That show will be Friday, March 27th at 9 a.m. right here, wherever you are listening to Utah Public Radio. The Source is a production of Utah Public Radio with support from iUtah. Special thanks to Ryan Cunningham, who produced most of today's show. Our theme song was written and performed by Megan Simper. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Find me on Twitter at Year of Jen. And you can engage with the show at Utah Public Radio. Use the hashtag UPRSource. Recordings and more information about today's show are also at upr.org. Thanks for listening.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn how Elizabeth Randall Cumming came to Salt Lake in 1858 as the wife of Utah's first non-Mormon territorial governor. Her expectations of the journey were defied every step of the way. First this.
I'm Cynthia Buckingham, director of the Utah Humanities Council. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. UHC is proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories as part of our statewide tour of the Smithsonian exhibition, Journey Stories. Tune in each week for a new Utah journey story from the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Believing the Mormons were in rebellion in the late 1850s, the U.S. government sent army troops to Utah, both to monitor the population and to provide a military escort for Alfred Cumming, an Easterner appointed as the new territorial governor. Cumming's wife Elizabeth would be Utah's new first lady. While waiting for Alfred's orders to travel, Elizabeth made plans to set up housekeeping at their new post. Relying on newspaper accounts of the situation in the Utah Territory, Elizabeth was as skeptical of the Mormons as they were of her and her husband. As she prepared to say goodbye to Boston, Elizabeth knew that she was leaving not only her physical home, but the only society and people she knew. As she crossed the country, Elizabeth began to form her own conclusions about the journey west. She found the passage less difficult than advertised and wrote to her sister that sensational newspaper accounts of traveling west had some striking discrepancies from her own experience. Reaching the Utah Territory in April 1858, Elizabeth waited at Fort Bridger while Alfred went to Salt Lake City to claim his leadership and demand recognition from the Mormons. The Cummings expected that Alfred might be imprisoned upon arrival, but he received a peaceful reception and Elizabeth soon joined him. During her 4 years in Utah, Elizabeth reported positively about her experiences. She was accepted into Mormon society and had many conversations with women about polygamy. Despite her personal aversion to local customs, Elizabeth wrote that the peculiarities of the Mormons were their own business, not mine, and was impressed by the women's avid expressions of faith. Elizabeth helped with her husband's official duties and gained the respect of the Mormon community. Her writings about Utah and its people in the 1850s provide a unique glimpse into how one woman established herself in a new land and among a new people. This episode of the Beehive Archive was contributed by Heidi Tuck. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the College of Science at Utah State University. Public outreach information on our Facebook page, Cache Valley Science Kids. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science. And by Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread in Logan, open for breakfast Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. and Saturday at 8 a.m., offering a selection of French pastries and a variety of sweet and savory menu items. Details at crumbbrothers.com.
I'm Jennifer Pemberton with Water Source Facts. Scientists and engineers who study water quality and management issues like to joke about their work by saying they're drowning in data. From mountain peak to river bottom, data collectors are everywhere, and they produce an endless stream of bytes and bits about water quality, water temperature, flow, and on and on. But managing and using all those ones and zeros can be cumbersome. So experts at the Utah Water Research Lab are coming up with ways to better collect and organize all this stuff. And they've sort of created a new discipline along the way. They call it hydroinformatics. Creating better tools for managing data is a growing theme in scientific research. In recent years, the National Science Foundation has even started requiring researchers to standardize and share their data so more people can use it. This new and improved collaboration among water experts could soon help us better understand the big picture about our water supply in Utah and around the world. Water Source Facts are part of UPR's partnership with Utah State University's 2015 Year of Water and the College of Engineering.
In 2011, composer Clarice Assad wove together a dozen tunes by Bach. The cellos and violas play the melodies, so it's called the Suite for Lower Strings, based on themes of Bach. 21st century music inspired by 18th century music, coming up on the next Performance Today from APM.
Friday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. This is Utah Public Radio. Thank you for listening today. Stay tuned. 10 o'clock.